From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, and I am filling in for Tony Perkins. Well, yesterday, Democratic Texas Representative Joaquin Castro, the twin brother of presidential hopeful Julian Castro, tweeted the names and employers of more than 40 San Antonian Texans who maxed out their donations to President Trump and his reelection campaign. Now, presumably, he wanted to name and shame them, right? Well, what has happened to civility in our political dialogue? In just a moment, I'll talk with David Harsanyi, senior editor at The Federalist, about his piece addressing how this type of action is downright un-American. In my second segment, a federal judge continues to block Arkansas's three pro-life laws. I will talk with Petrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, with her analysis. And at the bottom of the hour, after so much bad news out there, how about some good news? I'll tell you about a victory against the off-sited drag queen story hours and drag queen functions. Activist Mommy Elizabeth Johnson secured a victory by convincing an Ohio venue to cancel a drag queen event after just one call. She will join me to discuss. And at 42 past the hour, in light of the two mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, in addition to Gilroy, California, at the hands of disaffected young, angry men, I will talk to Dr. Warren Farrell, author of The Boy Crisis, about what might be connecting all of these young gunmen. As a reminder, you can listen to our broadcast at tonyperkins.com. We've got resources, guest information, and clickable links on that site. Follow Tony on Twitter at T. Perkins, or me, if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, it seems as if, even though we are about a year and a half out from the general election in the presidential race in 2020, we are already playing some dirty politics. And no one typifies this better than Democratic Texas Representative Joaquin Castro, who chairs the presidential campaign of his twin brother, Julian. He decided to tweet out the names and employers of more than 40 Texans in San Antonio who maxed out their donations to President Donald Trump's reelection campaign. Now, as my next guest points out, we need to remember that the federal maximum is $2,800 per individual. So we're not talking about millions and billions of dollars. This is not Tim Gill making a donation of $500,000 to the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is $2,800. Well, what we're doing is we are dealing with conduct that is deemed by my next guest to be downright un-American. David Harsanyi is a senior editor at The Federalist. He is author of First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, From the Revolution to Today. David, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, so when you first discovered this tweet by Representative Castro shaming Trump donors and associating them with overt racism, what was your first reaction?
I got pretty angry about it. I think it's when I say un-American, I'm not just throwing that around frivolously. I think when you have the state and a politician is part of the state, and people need to remember these are his own constituents as well, targets Americans for their beliefs. I think that's a big problem. I think it is un-American, and not just that, he curated a list that specifically went after certain kinds of people, and most of the people on that list were retirees or, you know, had businesses. And doing this not only undermines something very important. I mean, the Federalist Papers and many of the founding documents were written anonymously, and anonymity is incredibly important in a free society, so that people can speak out without fear. He's undermined that ideal, I think, and it's a dangerous norm to be breaking in politics.
So Let me talk, first of all, about the fact that these were individuals who were painted as being overtly racist by Representative Castro. And we understand that that's a bit of a dog whistle on the left right now. Everyone who supports Trump or votes for Trump is a racist. This is sort of 200-level political rhetoric. And we know that not everyone who supports Donald Trump is a racist. So to make this sort of broad brush negativity in your political discourse, to not only publish the list of names and the list of employers, yes, all publicly and readily available, but not in a compiled list. And we understand the nature of these lists can indeed be used as hit lists. I give you the Southern Poverty Law Center. Why does the left persist in the dialogue of racism, even when the facts don't support the narrative?
Oh, because many people on the left, and, you know, and this happens in politics, unfortunately, don't have neutral principles anymore. So when they want to attack, you know, they want to do something that is clearly outside the norms of politics, they convince themselves and rationalize what they're doing by saying everyone that they're attacking is a Nazi. So if you're attacking, who doesn't want to attack a Nazi, right? Everything's okay. Everything's on the table. Well, that, first of all, it's obviously ridiculous that most or any, you know, other than a small sampling of Trump voters are, you know, Nazis or even white supremacists. They simply have a different set of beliefs. But more than that, even if they were, you still can't, you know, you still shouldn't use lists of voters. This is a country that's free speech. People have bad ideas and hateful ideas sometimes. It doesn't mean that we strip them of their rights, because that's obviously a slippery slope. So, you know, for you to simply take a list. By the way, these campaign, you know, donor lists are meant to keep politicians honest. They're not meant to be used as enemies lists by politicians. It's not the purpose of them to begin with. And just because they're public information doesn't mean anything. People's addresses are public information. We shouldn't put them up there and, you know, and get our Twitter feeds to go and harass people. And lots of things are public information. So, you know, I forgot the original question. I'm off on a tangent. But I think that's so it's just important to remember that they're rationalizing actions that are outside the norms and could be dangerous. I mean, one of these people, you know, could be harassed. Their business could be destroyed. And by the way, these businesses have many people working for them. It's not just one person. They help the community. They have people who are employed by them who have nothing to do with politics to begin with. So it's just it's an increasingly ratcheted up, you know, rhetoric, and it could turn – you know, it has turned violent in a way, but it could turn violent even more. And it's just not how I think we want to conduct ourselves.
I'm glad that you mentioned the notion of anonymity, because I'll cite from your own article in the 1995 Supreme Court ruling McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Commission. The Supreme Court rather famously stated anonymity is a shield from the tyranny of the majority, and there is no tyranny right now more vocal or more active than the hard left progressive movement. Antifa is a perfect example of that. And indeed, the publication of this list came a day after protesters were outside Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's house, shouting death threats and broadcasting it on Facebook Live. We know Tucker Carlson has been doxxed. His home has been surrounded by Antifa, who threw eggs at the door while the two daughters and his wife were home. So this is a progressive ratcheting up of political discourse. You beautifully called it political zealotry. And it rises to a level of almost ultra-religious thought, ultra-religious fanaticism. But is this sort of part and parcel of what we're going to see in the coming election season? Do you anticipate more of this or less of this?
Well, I don't see why there shouldn't be more, in the sense, I mean, I don't see anyone bringing, you know, people together or kind of trying to lower the temperature, obviously, you know, which, I mean, today I was on social media, which is not a reflection of the real world, but I saw many journalists and many, you know, Democrats defending the use of this list. In fact, Castro himself, I think, was on Morning Joe or whatever defending it, and Morning Joe was defending it. So, you know, it's not as if people were like, yeah, we made a mistake, we're going to take a step back. No. When you're dealing with Nazis, supposedly, you know, anything's on the table. So I don't really see it getting better. And, And that's a scary proposition. In essence, what we're doing is we're taking the ugliness of social media, Twitter, let's say, and we're transposing that and moving it into the real world. And that's an ugly world to be in, because typically when we're walking around in society, we treat, you know, I don't even know what my neighbors think about politics, most of them, and then we treat each other with respect, and we don't boycott each other and ignore each other. And well, that's how we're going to start acting in the real world. It's going to get ugly very quickly.
You called Castro a lightweight authoritarian, which I love. Is that because you believe he has no legitimate chance of actually surviving a Democratic primary?
No. I said he might be. I think he is, absolutely. And, you know, his brother is polling at like 1% or 0%. I don't think he will survive. But here's the thing. I mean, they call everyone Nazis. What if a social conservative said, listen, you guys are in favor of genocide of unborn babies, and we're going to just do whatever we have to stop it? They would think that that was completely fascistic, and they would think that that was violent. And if everyone starts thinking like them, you know, then it's definitely going to get ratcheted up and very quickly. So, I don't know. So I do stand by lightweight authoritarian. Lightweight because he has no real power, thankfully.
Well, to the extent that this was quite a PR stunt and it garnered a lot of activity on social media, he probably experienced a modicum of success today. But I don't think this sort of bears any notion of his intended or perceived success in the future. So what we're looking at in these lists is essentially naming and shaming, but it's also sort of a veiled threat in a way. It isn't just we're going to uncover who you are, and so therefore you individually will be doxxed, but it is rather a subliminal threat, isn't it, to other individuals who donate to Republican candidates or to President Trump in his reelection campaign, as if we see you, you can do nothing in secret without us discovering it and punishing you for that political sin.
Of course. It's a warning. It's a warning to people, listen, you can max out the Donald Trump's reelection campaign, but maybe we're going to find your name and destroy your business. People are going to try to avoid that sort of thing because, you know, frankly, their businesses are more important to them than politics. Most people aren't, you know, I've been writing about politics for a long time. I'm out there. It doesn't really bother me when people call me names or make my life uncomfortable by calling me names. But a normal person doesn't want to deal with that sort of stuff. A normal person doesn't want to be harassed. No one wants to be harassed. So it definitely is a warning. And I don't know if it's – I hope it backfires, and I hope that, you know, they lose support. But I don't know how it's going to turn out. I would say this, though. That, we have laws that allow all these names to be public and who you give to, how much you give. This really should not be out there because it allows people like this to target them.
Yes, it does. And as we talked earlier about, these lists have consequences. Steve Scalise understands that. Tucker Carlson, Mitch McConnell, you show up in an area for a political sin of an unpopular opinion, and the left will now take it to your doorstep. David Harsanyi, senior editor at The Federalist, has been my great guest today. You're listening to Washington Watch. Coming up next, a federal judge continues her decision to block Arkansas's 3 pro-life laws. I'll talk with Petrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, coming up next.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC, sitting in for Tony. While I talked my last segment with David Harsanyi, Senior Editor of The Federalist, you've got to hear what Castro said about what he actually believed that this list would accomplish, what he wanted it to do. Listen to this.
What is the objective here? What do you hope will happen to the 44 private citizens whose names you posted? Do you want people to boycott their companies, protest outside their homes?
No, that was never my goal. It wasn't meant as a boycott. It wasn't meant to target these people. It was meant to draw attention to the fact that we've got a lot of people in our community who are respected by San Antonio, who are contributing to this guy that's using their money to fuel hate. So what I hope is that this has started a conversation about what exactly Donald Trump is doing with these people's money. Unless you support the white nationalism and the racism that Donald Trump is paying for and fueling, then I hope that you, as a person of good conscience, will think twice about contributing to his campaign.
But, Congressman, as you look at this list, I know you said you didn't put their addresses out there. It's easy to find them. These people undoubtedly are already being harassed online or perhaps face-to-face in some cases. What do you say to those people this morning who said, I made a campaign donation, and now I'm going to be harassed? I'm going to have people protesting outside my business or perhaps even my home. What do you say to them? Do you want them to repent for their support for Donald Trump, or what do you want from them?
I don't want anybody harassed or targeted.
But they will be because you put their names in public.
That was not my intention. These things are public. No, what I would like for them to do is think twice about supporting a guy who is fueling hate in this country.
But if you agree that rhetoric can lead to incitement, even if it just triggers one person to do something terrible, does it give you any pause about putting these people's names out in public?
Willie, they're already public.
There are 11 retirees and one homemaker who are not public.
Right. And this was already circulating. I shared it, so I didn't create the graphic.
Well, you hate to snort about that, but Representative Castro there on Morning Joe said, it was not my intention to harass. Well, that I have trouble believing. This is everyone who disagrees with me is a Nazi, which is an old and boring left-wing trope, but oh so common in political discourse. I'm joined now by Petrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy. We're going to shift gears and talk a little bit about an abortion law. An injunction that was just issued by a federal judge, Christine Baker, who issued a 14-day temporary restraining order, giving her more time to consider a lawsuit, by pro-abortion organizations so that she could consider some of the laws at issue. Patrina, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah.
Okay, so let's talk about this ruling. Now, this is a temporary pause button, so this really is not a long-term victory for Planned Parenthood or for the family planning organization. But she's considering these laws. Can you tell me a little bit about these particular laws, which you and I discussed were totally common sense?
Common sense laws, and these laws are so common sense that it shouldn't even be a discussion. The first one is, they already have a ban on abortions at 20 weeks, which is great. 20 weeks, we know a child can feel pain. And the higher the gestation of a child, the more risky the abortion is on a woman. So we know that we already have 20 weeks. This is an 18-week ban. The second one is a Down syndrome ban. Like, you can't kill a child just because they have an abnormality or disability. They still have value. This is a good thing. And the last one is, should be a no-brainer. The one who's performing the abortion needs to be certified as an OBGYN. That should be a no-brainer, that you do want women who are coming into these places not getting abortions by the same person who took their appointment behind the desk. But these are actual certified doctors who are doing the most invasive and violent procedure on a woman that could ever be done.
This is something that's always stymied me about the pro-abortion movement, is that common sense regulations, and let's take the least controversial of the three, you have to be board certified as an OBGYN to perform a medical procedure, a surgical procedure. Why fight a regulation like that? Because they can hold a straight face and say this actually impedes a woman's constitutional ability to get an abortion?
They will say that, and they're actually saying that this law will actually hurt women. It will hurt them physically. It will cause them to die. This law is hurting women. It makes no sense. But this is what happens when you have people who are worshiping abortion. They worship government instead of God, and they are bought and sold into this ideology to where common sense doesn't make common sense anymore to them. They really believe in this. So this is a good law. Like you said, this isn't the end of the road. This is temporary. So we hope to see a good report on this after 14 days.
Now, there's been a lot of activity state to state, whether it's Mississippi, it's Arkansas, whether it's Rhode Island, Vermont. Some states have taken the tact of protecting the life of the unborn. Some states have gone the exact opposite direction. We know that there are sort of death knells in the distance, potentially, of Roe versus Wade, which remains settled as of now, constitutional jurisprudence. Can we talk about what you think is sort of the state of the movement overall? Do you sense this is going in a more protective direction for the unborn?
I actually do. There's been numerous polling that has come out that showed that even pro-choice Democrats, those who identify as that, A, want protections for born alive infants after an abortion. They don't agree or support late-term abortion. All these things are significant and important. To me, it's encouraging to see that what the enemy had meant for good, when meant for evil, that the pro-life movement is turning for good. When Governor Ralph Northam said that it's okay to leave a child out on the table, we can decide whether we want it to live or not, that woke the country up, even people who identified as pro-choice. So now we're having pro-choice people who are willing to answer on polling saying, no, that's not okay. Late-term abortion is not okay. Withholding medical care from a child surviving an abortion is not okay. So you do have that, but you also have the abortion cult very angry because we have been winning at the state level for so long. And so for them, they are angry. And we have one of the most successful presidents in the pro-life movement so far in my time. So they're angry, and they will try everything they can to keep abortion on the table. But I think it's really energizing people who may have been in the middle.
That's encouraging. In fact, a recent Heritage Action study indicated that 76% of their respondents believed you should provide medical care to a baby that survived a botched abortion. Mm-hmm. Again, common sense, but maybe there is more common sense than the media is leading us to believe. Patrina has been my guest today, our Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy. You are listening to Washington Watch. Well, coming up next, Drag Queen Story Hours, Drag Queen Events. Not always as easy as planned for those who want to engage in them. And we'll tell you about a victory with the activist mommy. Coming up next on Washington Watch.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council. I'm filling in for Tony Perkins. Well, I'm sure you've heard of Elizabeth Johnston, the activist mommy. She has 70 million social media views. Her biblically focused commentary in which she confronts the lies of abortion, feminism, Islam, and the homosexual agenda have been viewed over and over again. She's the author of the new book, Not on My Watch, How to Win the Fight for Faith, Family, and Freedom. She and her husband, Patrick, have been pro-life ministry leaders for many years and homeschool their, get this, 10 children. Well, I thought I deserved a medal. I have 3, and that's where I drew the line. You can learn more about her at activistmommy.com. And over the last couple of years, she's shared several incidents of drag queen story hours taking place at public libraries and cases of child drag queens performing in highly sexualized ways for adults in bars, all manner of pro cross-dressing, gender-confused events for children. And she shares these for two reasons, to protect kids and empower parents. Joining me now with a great story of a victory she experienced recently is the activist mommy herself, Elizabeth Johnston. Elizabeth, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hi, Sarah. It's an honor to be with you.
So before we get to the good news, tell us what happened when you communicate to your like-minded parents about these drag queen story hours. This isn't the first incident that you've had to sort of cross paths with an event like this. What's been the parental response from the individuals who watch your videos and who deal with you about these events overall?
The parental response is definitely outrage. People cannot understand what types of parents are taking their children to these drag queen events. And the truth of it, what we've learned is it's LGBT parents that are taking their children to these events, which is a stark reminder to all of us why it's so important and why we should not and have never allowed for LGBT parents to be adopting children. Children need a mother and a father, not two mothers, not two fathers. And so these LGBT parents who do not have an understanding of the importance of the natural man-woman family are taking their children into these compromising situations where they are being groomed by these drag queens. And so normal parents everywhere are infuriated, and that is why we've had so much success with shutting down these events, because all I have to do with my platform is put out a call for my telephone warriors to start calling the library where this is taking place or whatever the venue is, and to ask that they not allow the library to be hosted in that venue. And we have shut down several events. The neat thing about this one that you and I are going to discuss today is that this is the first time we shut one down at a private business.
Yeah, so let's go to that right now. Let's talk about this particular event and actually what transpired, because there was a drag queen event featuring, and this turns my stomach, a nine-year-old drag queen whose name was Miss Mayhem, whose exploitation was so compelling that some local lawmakers are trying to get the child drag queen events banned because there's a loophole in these child exploitation laws. But let's talk about this particular event. Where was it and what happened?
So I have not revealed the name of the business because they did the right thing and pulled it, and I do not want to give them this negative advertisement. So it is a store that is a chain in malls, and they were bringing in this Drag 101 show through their cosmetics department, because of course drag queens are known for their cosmetics, and they were going to do a cosmetic show in this at this it's so hard for me not to say the name of it and I'm not going to say the name at this business. And I called management just to warn them before I started the campaign that this was completely inappropriate, that we did not believe children should be placed in these compromising situations, and certainly a nine-year-old should not be a drag queen, period, much less paraded before others as if it's something normal for a boy to be traipsing around in a very caricature-like female, you know, clothing and whatnot. And the I called several managers, and I was getting to run around, and no one wanted to talk to me, and they were upset, and they were avoiding me. And then finally I got to one of the managers, and he said, "We're not going to do it. We're not going to do it." I said, "Great. You've made the right decision. I am sure the store owners, who it's a family-owned business from what I understand, would not want this kind of negative attention brought to their business." And so typically we are fighting these drag queen story hours at libraries, and we have a lot of grounds to do so because libraries are taxpayer funded, right?
Right.
And we send our children to libraries to learn educational things, reading and writing. And we this week have just exposed in a UK taxpayer-funded library, a drag queen was teaching children how to twerk. And unfortunately, a lot of your listeners are going to have to go Google that word, but it's a terribly sexually exploited thing going on.
Oh, Elizabeth Johnson, we are grateful for you. This is a great series of lessons for Washington Watch listeners. It is time for parents to stand up, number one. And number two, let me tell you, you are the kryptonite to all influences that you want to prevent influencing your children. Elizabeth Johnson has been my guest. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Well, in the spate of recent shootings, we'll talk a little bit about what might connect these angry young men with Dr. Warren Farrell, coming up next on Washington Watch.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics, but they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council. I am filling in for Tony Perkins today. TonyPerkins.com is our website. At T Perkins is Tony's handle on Twitter. At Sarah P. Perry is mine. Go to our website and find more information about today's show and guests there. Well, it's been a dark series of days if you follow the national news. And in light of three mass shootings, one in Gilroy, California, one in El Paso, Texas, and one in Dayton, Ohio, all at the hands of disaffected young, angry men, I wanted to talk with Dr. Warren Farrell, author of The Boy Crisis, who had an op-ed that appeared just a few months ago in USA Today that was rather prescient, talking about how there is a crisis in America. Dr. Farrell, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
So we had an unprecedented 72 hours in the national news feed, and these three shootings, in very short order, were all committed by young men, almost following an identical profile. So when you heard about these three shooters, Santino Ligon out in California, Patrick Crucius in Texas, and Connor Betts in Dayton, Ohio, did you immediately connect this to your previous work and research and think this is part of the boy crisis?
Absolutely. We often blame the shootings on family values, on guns, on President Trump's divisiveness, supposedly on violence in video games, violence on TV. But women have access to the same guns, the same violence on TV, the same violence in video games, the same president, whatever president there is at the time. And girls have not been doing the shootings. The boys are. So this is really one of the indicators of a boy crisis. And so, you know, for 14 years, I've been doing the research on, you know, why boys are falling behind in all 56 of the largest developed nations, and in every single academic subject, including reading and writing, which are the biggest predictors of success. And what I found was that the developed nations give much more permission for two things. One is for divorce, and for there to be minimal father involvement after divorce. and the other is for women to have children without being married. And so in the United States today, we have 53% of women under 30 who have children without being married. And you could argue that from any number of perspectives, moral or immoral, but putting that aside for a moment, the powerful effect on boys is that many of those boys and girls don't know their fathers at all. Others know their fathers very slightly, and others know their fathers very well when they're 1, 2, 3 years old. But on average, unmarried couples, the father has minimal or no father contact after 4 years. And so it's in that last group of boys and girls, but especially boys, where the problems are germinate. And I started looking at mass shooters and found the vast majority of mass shooters were dad-deprived boys. I looked at started looking at the ISIS recruits. The vast majority of the ISIS recruits are dad-deprived, and about 90% of male prisoners are dad-deprived boys. And so I really started seeing that that of all the things that were impactful, we talk about mental health being the problems or drug abuse being the problem, but in fact, what I discovered when I did the research for the boy crisis is that the mental health problems and the drug abuse problems and the depression and the suicide were all outcomes of children that had minimal or no father involvement, with a much greater impact in a negative way on boys who have no role model and do not have the permission in society to ask for help, to share what is bothering them, and to speak up and know how to get support and have good emotional and social skills.
So there are many facets to this boy crisis that you describe. And as the mother of two boys and a daughter as well, but particularly as the mother of two boys, both of whom are very different from one another, but whom I would say are prone to the sort of standard boy distractions and deviations from the boring aspects of life, the video games and the roughhousing and the propensity to take things out physically on each other. I'm most curious to kind of take apart this notion of boy crisis, because you define it as being a crisis of a couple of different things. Can you tell us what some of those are?
Yes, education. Mentioned about boys doing worse in every single academic subject, but especially reading and writing, the biggest predictors of success. It's mental health. Boys, especially boys without dads, are far more likely to commit suicide, but even taking boys as a group, when boys and girls are the same age, or are 9 years of age, their suicide rates are the same. When they're between 10 and 14, boys' suicide rates are twice that of girls. When they're 15 to 19, four times that of girls. And between 20 and 24, five times that of girls. And so we see that boys are far less likely to not discuss their problems, to keep them inside, to implode, and then eventually have, you know, feel that withdraw into things like video games. Video games have some very positive values, but they have very negative values when they get to the addiction stage, which is somewhere around the 14, 15 hours a week playing video games. This is not all electronics. This is video games alone. Nice. Boys are far more likely to play that 15-hour a week of video games versus girls, who are far more likely to limit it to about 5 or 6 hours a week, in which case those are just fine, or at least most are just fine. And the addiction to the video games is usually a result of not being able to feel effective in life. And so, and here's the way that sort of tends to you asked for sort of the other evidences. So those are obviously psychological problems, mental health problems when you commit suicide or when you become depressed, and then taking that out on opioids or drugs, which is why there's a 2-to-1 death by opioids from males versus females. Mm-hmm. And then the single biggest predictor of suicide is dad deprivation. In terms of physical health, boys have 50% lower sperm counts than they used to have. They're likely to have lower IQs than they used to have. in terms of education, particularly in the United States. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell pointed this out on 60 Minutes, that he said there's two crises that are occurring for America's future. He was focused on the economy. One was the cyber warfare crisis, and the other one is the boy crisis. And he said that one of the reasons that's exacerbating the boy crisis is because we're not preparing our boys with vocational education training for a future which is going to be far more affected by being able to program robots, having the jobs that control artificial intelligence, as opposed to being put out of jobs because of artificial intelligence taking over jobs. And so there's a greater need for, because we made this transfer from muscle to mental. You know, when I was a kid, if people did not have, if the non-academic boys in our class, they went into things that use their muscle for the most part. And nowadays, those muscle jobs, those are the ones being taken over to a greater degree. And so we're needing to have boys go into vocational education, skill training in significant numbers. And when they do, the boys have purpose. And when boys have a job, so if they're a plumber making $120,000 a year, a woman is interested in having her be a dad. But if he's on the unemployment line, which is what happens when boys do not get that vocational training, if they're not academically inclined, they're likely to drop out of high school. And when they drop out of high school, there's a 22% likelihood in their early 20s that they won't have a job. When they don't have a job, their testosterone starts becoming very destructive. As opposed to boys that have focus and purpose, they tend to have their testosterone channeled constructively.
So we're talking about something that is really sort of reaching the tentacles, reaching its roots down into the very social fabric of the construction of the American family. And the facts after Parkland, Florida, which was Valentine's Day of 2018, was that 26 of the 27 most recent mass shooters all came from fatherless backgrounds. Nicholas Cruz, obviously, at the time, going into the Parkland, Florida, Majory Stoneman Douglas High School, had an adoptive father who died when he was very young. And then recently, we see these three shooters, two of whom, if my research is correct, come from intact families. Is there something there attributable, not singularly to fatherlessness, but a different element of that boy crisis, something that may potentially have been preventable because it does appear that these families were intact?
Yes, and there are, of course, other issues besides the fatherlessness per se. For example, in the Patrick Crugius situation, which was the boy that basically lost his father to divorce at the age of 13, but the father who wrote about his own life acknowledged that he that basically the entire family and the relationship with his wife was completely messed up and dysfunctional for all of Patrick's life. And so you can have, you know, you can do the research. We can do the research through the media that says this person that did live in an intact family, but even if they did, if the father is essentially dysfunctional, not present, or the mother is dysfunctional and a drug addict, not mm-hmm. present, or too doting and helicopter parenting like, and everything is all about the boy, then parents who are like that, where everything is all about the boy or all about the girl, and the family, those children tend to become very entitled. They don't have the key component of success. And the key component of success is postponed gratification. Mm-hmm. And that postponed gratification tends to come as a result of it, both parents being on the same page about boundary enforcement. So, for example, most typically, mother and father will set boundaries very similarly. They'll both say, here's your ice cream and here's your peas. You can't have your ice cream until you finish your peas. And the kids will, of course, test boundaries in the same way. They'll try to have as few peas as possible before they can get their ice cream. The difference tends to be in the way that moms versus dads tend to enforce boundaries. And, of course, sometimes this is reversed. But the moms will tend to say, if the child is protesting having to eat all the peas, then the mom will say, okay, I'll tell you what, have half the peas.
And yes, then the child the light touch in our household.
You'll recognize this example then. And the consequences of this I'll share with you too. And then the mom will, and then the child will see, I can negotiate a deal here. So they might have, he or she might have half of those 20 peas or whatever. And then mom says, okay, you know, at least he's trying. And I'm not going to use, you know, especially if it's been a day where there's very little time with the son or daughter. So I'm not going to use my few precious moments to have a big argument over a few peas. That's ridiculous and insensitive. So, okay, sweetie, you tried. Thank you. You can have this many more peas and then you can have your ice cream. And so the son and the daughter don't have to focus their attention on what they need to do, that is, finish all the peas to get the ice cream. Dad is more likely, on average, to say, excuse me, here, we have a deal. The deal is you can have your ice cream when you finish your peas. You know that's the deal. I know that's the deal, and you know I know that's the deal, so finish your peas. Oh, you're so mean, Daddy. You can continue to whine and complain, then there'll be no ice cream tomorrow night either. Oh, all right, I guess I need to finish my peas, otherwise I don't get ice cream. And the more I complain, the more I'm going to have problems not getting what I want to have. So when we measure children brought up predominantly by moms versus dads, only 15% of the children raised predominantly by dads have ADHD. 30% of the children raised predominantly by moms have ADHD, because the child raised by the dad learns he doesn't have the option of getting his reward, his postponed gratification, until he focuses on doing the things he doesn't want to do, eating those peas, before he gets the ice cream. Versus with the child learns, if I noticed that mom was really responsive when she had a tough day or when there was a divorce and she feels guilty about that. So if I say to mom, you know, I really miss dad, mom is far more likely to let me have fewer peas before I get my ice cream. And so the children with that type of background of the lack of boundary enforcement tend to become very good at being coercive and trying to manipulate more effectively. And then that exhausts the mom, which becomes even more exasperating for the mom and more exploitive from the child. Now, the real impact of all this is when that postponed gratification gets taken to school or a school activity. So say the mother is, usually moms are very good about being able to sort of sense what the children are good at and encourage them to do more of what they're good at and see the uniqueness in the child. So the child may be good at school or wants to be an actor or a musician, so the mom really fosters the child going after his or her dream and encourages them to do the discipline. The dad is more likely to say...
Dr. Warren Farrell, I'm so sorry I have to cut you off.
We are almost out
of time. Your book is The Boy Crisis. It is available on Amazon. This has been Washington Watch. We have a crisis of boys, and it leads directly to fathers, an encouragement for fathers to be present and involved in their children's lives. I have been Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Wednesday edition. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.